From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network, Dr. Yi Liu and graduate student Nathan Seracki from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign are interviewed by Gen's editor-in-chief John Sterling on the development of a new buffer that resists pH changes even as the temperature drops.
Dr. Yi Liu is a professor of chemistry at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Nathan Seracki is a graduate student in chemistry at the university. Dr. Liu, you and your research team have formulated a buffer solution that maintains a desired pH even as lab samples containing the buffer are cooled. Could you provide our listeners with more details about your novel buffer?
So what we have done is to develop a general method that can formulate buffers at a desirable pH that can maintain the pH throughout a temperature anywhere from room temperature to down very low temperature. Specifically, what we have demonstrated in our publication that we have developed a buffer at pH 7, the physiological pH that most people use, that maintains pH from 25 degrees approximately room temperature to minus 180 degrees both Celsius, and then that's close to liquid nitrogen temperature. And furthermore, we also demonstrated that such a buffer has a beneficial effect, so they can maintain an integrity and efficiency of the pharmaceutical drugs, such as oxacillins, and when stored at very low temperature, but also biomolecules such as like human hemoglobins when studying the sample using spectroscopy at the low temperatures.
Why are the results of your research important to scientists working at universities, biotech, and pharmaceutical companies?
Right. First of all, a buffer, as you know, is utilized widely in biochemical research, biophysical study, and more importantly, biomedical research like pharmaceuticals. And they are used to maintain pH. But one thing that has been developed in the last, 20, 30 years, or maybe even longer, that people recognize low temperature is extremely good in terms of, if you store the sample at low temperature, you can keep them longer. You know, we all have a refrigerator, freezer at homes, and that's, in fact, in some food companies have even lower temperature refrigerator, freezers. And more importantly, a lot of scientists study this, they have to understand those biomolecules more detailed, so they like to freeze them even lower temperature, you know, something around minus 180 degrees or even lower, so that they can actually slow down and keep them longer, but more importantly, can take snapshot the picture of those molecules at the low temperature, so they can slow down the reaction. They can look at the so-called intermediates, the things that you do not see the normally at the normal room temperatures. One can see them, so they can actually allow them to develop, for example, drugs, pharmaceutical drugs for different diseases and applications. So low temperature is being used, buffer is being used, but again, for more than 75 years, people recognize, 75 years ago, people already know that one buffer at the room temperature and maintain the pH, say, 7. When you lower the temperature, particularly very low temperature, the pH of those buffer changes at 7, too, with a temperature. So that has been one major issue because one wants to study those samples at as close to pH 7, physiological pH as possible. But if it's a buffer that change pH, then the integrity of your sample will be compromised. For example, if it's pharmaceutical drugs, if you want to store them at low temperature, like oxacillin, the one we show in the paper at low temperature, then it will lose its efficiency. And more importantly, some biomolecules, for example, like hemoglobin, we show when you lower the temperature, then it also the sample integrity is the structure changes too. So then you will not be closer to their physiological temperature. So we need a buffer that would not change such a temperature. And then To our knowledge, no one has been able to make that, and they've been able to avoid it by not using the buffer, or they try to calibrate it, so-called calibrate, and try to compensate for it. But then I think we're the one, I think, that we developed such a buffer that will not change its pH. And therefore, I think the use of such a buffer in the future research, it will be very beneficial in terms of keeping the integrity of the biological, biomolecule samples, and also making the study much more relevant to that of a room temperature when they study them at room temperature.
To pick up on some of the points by Dr. Liu, Nathan, you actually demonstrated some of the problems caused by pH changes at low temperature by repeatedly freezing and thawing oxacillin, a penicillin analog that's used to treat infections. What were you able to show?
We were looking for how significant are these reported pH changes upon lowering the temperature, and are they significant enough to have a detrimental effect on such important things that need to be cooled as drugs or pH-sensitive biological materials. So we set out to find how much damage could really be done by freezing and thawing in a very common practice way at minus 20 degrees of a pharmaceutical drug known to be pH-sensitive. And I found oxacillin, which was a pharmaceutical drug still in use, very much so in use today, that has a very narrow pH range of stability. And to deviate from this range causes irreversible deactivation of the drug. And we thought this to be a perfect probe to study the effect of pH changes caused by different buffers. So we watched this drug degrade at different rates upon freezing and thawing according to the buffer composition that it was stored in. And so we have these buffer-dependent hydrolysis rates of this drug that we inferred were correlated to an increase in pH. And our results showed very clearly that the pH induced by these buffer molecules is a very specific direction and a very specific magnitude, predictable by other methods that have been known for about 20 years. And so we've, in essence, verified through the experiments with the drugs that these pH changes are significant, and they're significant enough to cause very, very important chemical reactions and, you know, conformational changes as far as biology is concerned.
Nathan, I was reading about the work you did, and it was very interesting. So I think our listeners would be interested if you could describe the steps that you followed, a little bit of mixing and matching, a little bit of here, a little bit there, to find the buffer that would maintain a stable pH at varying temperatures. Give us a little better idea of what you exactly did.
At first, we set out to probe the pH. How do you find the pH of a solution that has been iced over, that is not a liquid? You can't use a conventional pH meter to probe the pH at these low temperatures. So we sought out to find probes, and what have other people used to probe pH at low temperatures? And they're basically indirect methods to get an instantaneous picture of the protonation events that are going on. For example, we developed this buffer by using pH-sensitive indicator dyes. And so if a particular dye molecule gets protonated or deprotonated because of a pH event, you see a color change, and we can view these color changes at cryogenic temperatures through the iced block of sample that we're looking at. And so these color changes are free to occur and free to be monitored at these low temperatures. And we can infer these color changes are pH changes because we've calibrated them at room temperature to different pHs. So we at first quantified the magnitude of pH changes for several buffers, and we noticed that some buffers upon cooling caused an increase in pH, while other buffers upon cooling caused a decrease in pH. And the immediate obvious solution to that was to incrementally mix the solutions together to see if they would cancel out each other's effects. In essence, one species donate protons to another while the temperature is being lowered, maintain a constant pH as far as the samples being stored are concerned. And that's what we did, and we found that, indeed, upon mixing these reagents, the effects were canceled out incrementally, not as predictably as we would like, but we envisage that a lot more work in that field will enable us to come up with a predictable manner to come up with these buffers.
Dr. Liu, what are the implications of a temperature-independent pH buffer for both new and previously published research?
I think it's a huge, as I mentioned in answering your previous question, is that, you know, buffers used and temperatures, low temperatures being used in widely in many areas of research, both in university side and industry side, you know, wide range of applications. And you cannot walk in any kind of a biochemical or biotech company, biochemical lab or biotech company or biopharmaceutical company without them using any buffers and also without using any low temperatures. And then so one of the things that people always worry about, warning about is, you know, whether the buffer can maintain its pH at any low temperature they want. So the implication was that, you know, now with this buffer in hand, people do not have to worry about it. It used to be people had to either worry about it or they have to either, for some people, ignore it, but obviously that's not right. But some people, you know, have to worry about it or somehow had to be a careful calibration all the time in order to compensate for whatever the temperature, you know, dependent pH changes. With this new buffer in hand, they don't have to worry about it. They can feel free to use our buffer for any pH, you know, desirable pH they want, and any temperature they want without worrying about their pH going to change, so that the buffer will be true buffer at any temperature they like to use for, rather than have to, what happened, you know, to that buffer, that temperature, I have to check it in all the time. So I think that's really for the new research for sure. And also, you know, a lot of time, you know, maybe publications, there will be, you know, we have not really found, specific looking for example, but there could be example where people do not compensate for such a temperature dependent pH effect. Sometimes the conclusion may have something to do with pH changes rather than the temperature change, for example. I think that could be, maybe reinterpreted. But I think what we are interested in doing, obviously not looking back, is looking forward. I think that from now on, people have a new choices for a buffer that they do not have to worry about changing pH with temperature.
Nathan, you want to add anything to some of Dr. Liu's points?
He said it all. We've even had people in our lab who have asked to use it and who wanted to rule out, you know, in the short time it's been since we came up with the buffer, who wanted to rule out temperature or, you know, pH effects. And so the implications are they seem to be exactly widespread as you can imagine. This is a very general concept, and it's very, very powerful. And our studies show, not published yet, but that this is a very general approach. And it seems that these buffers can be developed, given the right components, at any pH and any ionic strength, concentration, et cetera.
Final question, Dr. Liu. How do you plan to make this buffer available to other scientists carrying out life science research? Have any companies approached you about making the buffer in large amounts and marketing on a larger scale?
Yeah, the first step is to obviously publish the paper in the peer-reviewed journal, which we did, and then make it widely available for people, so that actually we have a detailed procedure published online and also in journals, so people can follow that and they can actually feel free to use it for that. So that's number one. And I think number two thing that Nathan alluded to before, that you know, we want this empirical method more predictable. So I think our next step is actually and trying to rationalize what we have observed and maybe actually have some kind of a theoretical basis for such observations, so that we can actually make it more predictable, so that, you know, you can imagine we can make we're thinking about maybe make a website so that people can, if you want this pH, that particular, you know, ionic strength, and at the low temperature, and they can plug into this desirability, we can give you some kind of a formula. Previously, initially as an empirical that we have developed, but more importantly, maybe you have even a formula, empirical formula or some kind of combination of theoretical calculation, empirical parameters, so that one can actually be able to use it, you know, anytime they want. And we have not, because the paper just published recently, no company have approached us for, you know, commercializing the buffer yet, but I would imagine that is a possibility.
And Nathan, your view on making this buffer more widely available?
I think it's a very big possibility. Once again, the reasons for these pH changes are, for the most part, well established throughout the years, and this seems like a problem that could eventually be in the predictable realm. And the most powerful thing that we can envisage is a completely fundamental web-based calculator that takes just very fundamental parameters from the user and gives them the recipe, gives them the formula for whatever buffer they need. And so as general as possible, we hope to be able to just predict to a great extent these pH changes rather than just observe and solve the problem like that.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we'd like your opinion on this week's podcast. Please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and give us your thoughts. We would also appreciate it if you'd answer the following question. How do you think life science research can be advanced in light of the development of this new buffer solution? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the NextGen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.